There we go. All right.
Whatever. We are good on my end.
Okay, so technical issues with YouTube Studio. It did start, and then it kind of gave up the ghost on the stream, so I had to restart it. So here's a coronavirus brain teaser for you.
Uh-huh.
It has to do with logarithmic growth.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lake, and in the middle of this lake, well, it doesn't have to be in the middle, but somewhere in this lake, there's a single lily pad. And this particular species of lily pad will double every day. So mm-hmm. every lily pad will make another lily pad every day. Okay?
Okay.
And if the lake is completely covered after 50 days, how many days does it take to be covered halfway?
Halfway. Math isn't my strong suit, so let's go 25.
No, 49.
49.
This is the power of it's the same concept as compound interest.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Uh-huh.
So because it doubles every day, if it's 100% on day 50, that means day 49, it's halfway.
I see. Yeah, that's true. I didn't think about it that way.
Right. So what this means is that things that grow in an epidemic, you know, contagions,
mm-hmm.
Grows very slowly at first and then very rapidly.
This is true. And while we're on this topic, just wash your hands, people. You know, it's common sense. Do it for 20 seconds, soap and water. You'll be good.
Yeah, and if you're concerned about coming in contact with, you know, foreign surfaces out in the wild of the world, like at the store or the bus station or whatever, you know,
mm-hmm.
anything, you know, wash your hands afterwards. Don't touch your face.
Yeah, that too.
If you're worried about your can of soup you just bought, wipe it down with some soap and water.
Can't hurt at all.
And don't buy a truckload of toilet paper. Jesus.
Yeah. And don't invest in the face masks. Those are best left for people who are already sick and the doctors and nurses treating them.
Right.
So
they are exactly. So they're much. I happen to have a mask that I bought for woodworking. So I already had one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if it's the, virus grade or not. It might not be.
Yeah, who knows?
Right.
But, while we were talking about St. Louis, I actually had a couple of news items from there that are different. So, down in University City, which is a suburb down right through there, are a lot of bars, and it's close to WashU. Washington University. Some jackass dressed up like the Joker, face paint and all. And he took his phone and went to a bunch of different bars, Facebook Living, apparently making threats against people.
That's not funny.
No. And the cops didn't think so either, of course, but they arrested him, and then he starts saying, but wait, this is just performance art to bring attention to the opioid epidemic.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, fuck you, man.
That's, You know, that is totally cool right up until you start threatening people.
Yeah.
That's where your First Amendment ends.
Exactly. And it totally is when you're saying you're going to kill people. And talk about that, Florida man uses an infant as a shield when he's in a showdown with the police.
Was the infant's name Greta Thunberg?
Nope.
Because she's a child used as a shield.
Yep, she is, unfortunately.
Poor kid.
Yeah. God, oh, the Robert Durst trial started. That'd be interesting to keep up with. For fans of HBO's The Jinx, which is an excellent, excellent show, if you've never watched it.
I don't have HBO. My free period ended, and so I'm done with that.
Well,
I watched all of Game of Thrones, and then I didn't care if it ended.
I mean, Robert Durst, just his whole life was different, but the trial in question was about him killing a man, dismembering him, and leaving him in Galveston Bay. So,
oh,
yeah.
Hey, even Dexter almost got caught doing that shit.
Yeah. Yeah, he really did. But we'll definitely be keeping up, you know, updates on that as we hear them. Let's see.
What else you got?
Oh, yeah. Hayes County woman sentenced to life in prison for beheading her daughter after she asked for cereal.
Jeez Louise.
Not sure what the issues were there, but they found marijuana and booze in her system. That, to me, probably
neither one of those
it.
Are going to explain that away.
Yeah, you probably got some sort of mental illness going on there.
For sure.
Oh, yeah, the guy who licked the tubs of Blue Bunny ice cream got 30 days in jail, a $1,000 fine, and he has to pay restitution to the company of $1,565.
I'm okay with that.
B misdemeanor for that? I don't know. I think it should have been a little bit higher, personally.
I think the restitution should have been higher.
Oh, yeah, that too. But
I mean, I'm not, I don't think it's ideal, but I'm okay with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it's a weird case, though. Oh, yeah, voter fraud. Legit voter fraud.
No, it doesn't exist. I was told it doesn't exist.
Well, this one, it says, was a woman changing Democrat ballots to Republican ballots.
Really?
Down there in Florida, yeah. And what's really funny about it? It was somebody on our page pointed this out, and I didn't see it until I looked at it. Her picture. She looks just like Hillary Clinton. Not even kidding.
Oh, my word.
Like the bone structure and everything.
She's really gone like off her. The deep end now.
Yeah.
No, you're doing it wrong, Hillary.
Yep. Yeah, I think that is about...
What about Harvey? There's Harvey news, right?
Oh, yeah. He's got 23 years in prison. I believe they put him in Rikers. So
nice.
That's good.
Nice.
Get him out of the hospital.
Do you think his, you know, his walking, you know, his walk, needing a walker and all that, do you think that's legit or is that just for show?
It's showy bullshit.
Yeah.
Oh, a correction there on that news item. It's Blue Bell, not Blue Bunny.
Blue Bell ice cream.
My apologies to our Texas fans, Donna in particular, who is messaging me on Facebook about that. We fixed it. Yeah, I think that is really about it for now. Oh, wait a minute. No, it's not. No. Alex Jones, DWI.
Oh, Alex Jones.
That guy is a nut, and I'm sorry. Wow. I find it impossible to have sympathy for somebody who has repeatedly claimed that Sandy Hook was a hoax. Frankly, fuck you.
Yeah, why, of all things, why would you do that?
I have no idea. I mean, unless you're just
He had to have been on drugs, right?
One would think. I mean, I've also seen in court filings with him that he admitted to basically playing a part, that the whole Alex Jones thing is a persona that he does to make money, is essentially what the court filing said. I would have to look it up again, but...
I mean, sure, I get that, but how does... I mean, you got to have some discretion still, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you would think that you would at least have a soul enough to not make idiotic claims like that. So, yeah, I find very little reason to feel sympathy for that man at all when he uses his free speech right like that. So,
yeah. Yeah, you totally have the right to say what you want. You don't have the right to be free of the consequences of saying what you want.
No. No, and you don't have the right to defame people, which is what the suit that the Sandy Hook families filed was about. So, but yeah, I think that is it as far as news.
All right, we got a weird-ass case today.
That we do. Our first, actually, out of France, French serial killers. And they were, in essence, a serial-killing couple, not unlike Fred and Rose West, as probably the most...
Infamous.
The one that comes quickest to mind with all of that.
Yeah. But, serial killer couples are exceptionally rare.
Yeah. Yeah. Although the psychopathology is definitely different here. It's Fourneray, however you say it. I've never been all that good at pronouncing French.
I'm not even sure the French are. would go with Fourneray.
But he had a fixation on virginity, which, I mean, a lot of guys, you know, kind of do in the fantasy worlds, but this was totally taken to a pathological level, in my view, which we will see. And I was just getting to the page that I had on his history. It's here somewhere. He's born in 1942 in Sedan, which is going to be northern France. And yes, that is where the name for the car comes from, if I'm not mistaken. Born in 1942. It's actually near the Belgian border, too, up there. His father was a metal worker, and his mother was, as far as my source said, a farmer's daughter. So I would assume that means they have a little bit of money. And I'm not sure if the stereotypes there are necessarily true the way that some people argue they can be here in the United States with a farmer's daughter. But... yeah, he was a quiet child with a high IQ. He liked chess, and he liked classical music. But once he gets older, he struggles to hold down a lot of jobs and just goes through a string of them. Mm. And his first arrest was in 1966 for child molestation.
At what age? 66, so he would have been 24.
Yes. And that ended his first marriage as well. But when he got out, he remarried. He fathered three children. But this marriage dissolved when history repeated itself and he was found guilty of child rape. And it was during this time that he decides to put an ad while he's in prison, basically looking for a woman, looking for someone to talk to, as he said, you know, a lonely prisoner looking for someone to talk to.
Sure.
And he gets a response from this woman by the name of Olivier. And it builds sort of from there through their letters, which are surprisingly very passionate, very erotic. And it gets to the point where she promises to help him, quote, hunt virgins, and her quote was, look for the young sluts.
Wow.
Yeah.
So she just steps right up right from the beginning.
Yeah, essentially. That's what she does, Monique Olivier. And she says that she will help him do that as long as he kills her first husband, who was abusive.
So this was going through the prison mail system, for crying out loud?
Yeah.
What kind of snoops are they if they let this stuff go?
I expect more
out of the French, frankly.
Yeah. There's a whole huge level of permissiveness going on here that's just, yeah, it's wow. And the interesting thing there, being the con man that he was, Fourneret agreed to do this, but he never followed through on killing her husband.
Oh.
So, but interestingly, this whole virginity fixation that he has,
yeah,
it starts off, according to him, because of incest with his mother, who took his virginity.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not sure how much you can believe that, but that is what he himself said to shrinks once they finally caught him and put him away for good in 2003. So essentially what a lot of this became was a quest to reclaim his virginity and to hurt women in the process, so to get revenge.
Doesn't really work that way, none of it. For a smart guy, that's pretty dumb thinking.
Yeah.
But you know what? I mean, I kind of make fun of that, but so much of our lives really are governed by irrational beliefs that we form as children when we lack complete understanding. And those things drive so many aspects of our lives every day. We just don't go around, you know, typically causing torment to the world because of it.
Right. And we don't. And that's where I think a lot of this is him kind of clamoring for excuses. Because like another one was, he said that how the Nazis treated women left an indelible mark on me. It's like,
That's a little far-fetched, because the French were out of France by 1940, end of the summer of 44.
Yeah. So he would have been two. Yeah.
Now, granted, he could very well have heard stories later on.
Yeah, but he wouldn't have seen a whole lot as far as the war itself.
No.
But, I mean, the other stuff that he talked about, he describes misogynistically getting attached to the Blessed Virgin Mary as the ultimate symbol of womanhood. And that anything that is below that is not worthy, is garbage. And part of that,
the virgin whore complex.
Yeah. Well, there's that, but that was also driven home by, for a while, he stayed with his sister, and they had no indoor plumbing, so they had to use a bucket, right? And one day, he apparently saw his sister on the bucket, which disturbed him because he thought that perfect women should be above that sort of thing. That they should be above the biological, the profane, and the dirty.
Yeah, that is, you know, I kind of get that. I mean, it's not a thing that ever occurred to me, but I you know, the mm-hmm. way women, frankly, for, you know, a very long time, have worked very, very hard to present themselves as perfect.
Yeah.
And to a young man who doesn't know any better, he might just, you know, have been told or developed this belief that women are, you know, are this, you know, special breed of creatures that don't have any biological functions.
Yeah, he may have. But, you know, you distill that experience with his sister down to its logical end, it makes all women dirty.
Mm-hmm.
When you get down to it. But I think we'll see that reflected in his crimes, which we get right into that. You know what? We can get back to that part later. I actually have how he was caught first in here, so let's skip that for now. Let's see. Oh yeah, there was a rather interesting interview that I watched about a woman who was raped when she was 14 by Fournet. This was September of 1982. Much of this is in her own words. She says, "I was returning home after a day out with my brother and my boyfriend. I arrived at Epernon Station. I think a man who later turned out to be Fournet followed me. He grabbed me by the arm a little farther and forced me to go with him by showing me a little bottle that he said contained sulfuric acid."
And he threatened her with the acid then.
Essentially, yeah. Which is a rather interesting way to do that. We don't see it all that often.
Yeah, no, really not. And what's especially interesting about that is, you know, how do you know if it's not, or if it is, right?
This
is true.
It
could be a bottle of water for all you know.
That's very true. She goes on to say, "He said he had stolen a car and the police were after him, and that he was taking me as a hostage. He had probably parked there so he could see who was getting off at the train and choose his victim the way he always did." So I guess she assumed he had done it before. And that was me. I was sort of the victim he was looking for that day. And it turned to sort of small talk once they were in the car, oddly enough. I thought he was a French teacher. He presented himself as sophisticated. Is essentially what she said. He said he had been given a Catholic education and that he was a virgin when he got married. And on his wedding day, he found out his wife was not a virgin. Since then, he has been chasing the myth of virginity. He said he would simulate an act of rape. He would behave as if he were raping me. So he tied me up, then got undressed, and instead of simulating it, he did actually try to rape me. But he suffered from premature ejaculation. Surprise. And and kind of like Chikatilo, who we talked about last week, he's unable to penetrate. And what was so weird about that, though, the French court found that this woman's story, her name is Diana, D-I-H-A-N-A, it found that Diana's story did not amount to rape.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah. So Fourniré got off light with no follow-up. And he was, essentially, they were manipulated into not reporting. And she even, after all this went down, he had her so screwed up in the head at the time that she even wished him good luck getting out of the car.
Wow.
Yeah. That shows the level of sociopath that you're looking at here.
You know, you could, the charm, sociopathic charm.
It's, despite threatening to throw acid on you, that's what you get. But he ended up being arrested in 1986 for 17 different pedophilic offenses. And he's brought to trial in 1987 near, I can't even read my own damn writing there, Uncy, E-U-N-C-Y, which is near Paris. And Diana was forced to testify during that. And she says during it, "I could see more compassion for him than for me with the jury.
Wow.
I didn't look like a victim and he didn't look like a predator," is what she said. So, rape became what the French titled the charge as an incident assault, not indecent, incident assault.
Wow.
And it contributed to his early release. But during that incarceration, he gets to know Monique through a singles ad. She despises her ex-husband, like I said, and is looking for a way out. So she writes again, knowing full well that this guy is a sex offender, a hardened sex offender. And they meet when he's convicted. And then from the very beginning, like I said as well, there's a lot of passion in their letters. And it was vastly about him getting revenge on the men who wronged her. And then also, back to that quote again.
Yeah.
Her getting him the young slits. But by the end of 87, Fourniré is a free man, and he moves in with Monique Olivier in Saint-Cyrille-Catalogne, where no one knows him. And he was also not properly monitored here or anything. None of the steps that you would consider as being logical here in the United States for a sex offender.
Well, you know, even here in those days, it wasn't as extensive as it is now.
Yeah.
I don't think it was until even the 90s that we had registries.
Probably true. I mean, I'm not totally sure of the year, but yeah, they had even less than that back in those days when, you know, what we are talking about there. Mm-hmm. But, so they move in together and it gets to the point to where they started killing. There was a neighbor that I saw an interview with on one of the sources who says on one occasion, Fourniré appeared before a judge in the morning And he murdered a girl in the afternoon, same day.
Jeez.
Yeah. But 6 weeks past his release, he's age 45 by now, he commits his first murder. A girl by the name of Isabel LaVille, age 17. He strangles her at his home. And a few months later, he shoots Fabienne Lurcy, age 20. And then we get to Jean-Marie de Ramal. And she is a petite figure. She's kind of religious by nature. She looks about 15 to 17,
yeah.
But she's really age 22. And she had this rather different living arrangement worked out, where she lived at a convent with nuns during the week, okay, while she studied modern languages at a local school. And then during the weekend, she would go home. But
well, that's different.
Yeah, it is. It really is. But she met Fourneret on a train where he sat opposite her. And she was apparently reading a book, something like an Ordo, you know, that would be very familiar to Catholics. And he starts questioning her about that, and they, you know, strike up a conversation, and they apparently like each other. So he asks her, how about, you know, coming to meet me and my wife and all that? And she thinks about it, and she ends up giving her, or giving him her information, you know, where she lives, where she goes to school. And this, of course, is info that he uses to stalk her once you get down to it. But, in January of 1989, she told the sisters.
That's interesting. You know, he was able to lure some girls without his wife.
Yeah, he really was. Yeah, because she wasn't around during this part of it. But January 89, Jean-Marie tells the sisters she met a very nice man, and he asked her if she'd like to meet his wife and stay at the weekend. And the nuns, to their credit, were like, are you sure that you can trust this guy? Even though he has a wife.
Right.
But, yeah, she says sure. So Saturday, March 18th is when they finally scheduled that, where Jean-Marie intends to take the train home. And one of the nuns dropped her off. And as soon as they left, it was Olivier and Fournier showed up and said, let us give you a ride. We can come back to my place and, you know, we can have coffee and all that. So they do that, and they spike her coffee with tranquilizers, right?
Right.
Fournier, then, he just comes straight out, and he asks her, are you still a virgin? And it's at this point that she says, no, I have a boyfriend, and I want to leave. And, of course, they don't allow her to leave.
Right.
Fourneret flies into a rage about this. He starts abusing her right then and there and starts shouting, if you can do it with somebody else, why can't you do it with me? And this leads to a fight where apparently Jean-Marie really kept up her own. She even knocked out one of the glass windows of the house.
Oh.
Yeah. And keep in mind.
And then she's drugged, too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, keep that in mind, too, that she's got, you know, probably Valium or something else like that in her system that would be making it harder for her to do that.
Yeah.
And, unfortunately, The two got the best of her, and she was raped and violently murdered. And nobody in the tiny village where they lived of Flowing, F-L-O-I-N-G, heard or saw a thing during this. And literally, well, the houses...
Are they living in that manor house that we've been seeing?
No, that chateau? No. They aren't in the chateau yet. They are in a tiny house in this tiny village.
Okay.
And the houses there are about 75 meters apart.
That's a good distance.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, would that be enough to hear a window breaking and presumably a female yelling loud? I don't know.
Depends what other, you know, what the ambient noises are in the village, right? Is it is it super quiet? Is there a lot of traffic? You know, is there a lot of outdoor activities?
The impression that I got with it when I was doing the bit of research was that it's a very agricultural. So you might have, you know, cattle and things like that as your ambient noises, but I don't know. I mean, maybe there's more.
Well, and how many trees are around the house too? Because that'll disrupt sounds.
Yeah, that's very true. But the neighbors did also say that Fournere liked to live there, like, in their words, a hermit.
Mm-hmm.
So that could have contributed too. Oh, I'm sorry. It wasn't 75 meters. It was 25.
Okay.
Was the closest house. My apologies there.
Well, it's enough for a first down.
yeah, this is true.
If you can make that pass. Still, yeah, a lot of it, there's a lot of factors. 25 meters, you know. If I'm inside and there's a noise at my neighbor's house, something like that, yeah, I might hear it. Depending on what I'm doing and what's going on else outside, yeah, I might hear a window break. Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if it's agricultural, a lot of people go to bed early.
This is true. This is definitely true. But yeah, it sort of escalated from there for him too. You know, and I think the sexual dynamic that was going on here, both of them got off to Fournier's domination and torturing of these women before he would kill them.
Yeah.
And it was is what one psychiatrist called a perverse love that was there. It's both Olivier and Fournier kind of got off with this.
I understand the perverse side. I do not understand the love aspect of it, of this explanation.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't either. It's love in the sense of sex. Once you get down to it. And that has, as you know, and as we've talked about, a very wide diagnostic definition on this show. Now, that's the only sense that I use that word there, too, is diagnostic. Or taxonomic, if you will. Just one way to classify what's happening here. It's almost like the victims themselves were incidental to the totality of what was going on, too. You know, that they were...
I mean, that's not often the case. They're just... The victims are just objects to these kinds of people.
Right. Right. They're there to have terror be struck on them. They are there to show the effects of the terror that's being struck upon them, the sadism of Fournier and probably in Olivier too. We don't have any direct examples of her being sadistic, as far as I know. But there's no doubt that she didn't try to stop it. And I think there's no doubt that she enjoyed watching it, too.
Yeah. Well, there's a... is this a good time to talk about her?
In what sense did you want to?
Well, I mean, just the whole mentality of her wanting to get involved in this.
I mean, Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I've seen, you know, so many cases of things that women do when they're mad at somebody or hurt, you know?
Yeah.
And the lengths that they will go to when they've been emotionally hurt. Most, you know, like 99% of the time, not this far, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where I think that there's a good chance that this started out that way, but it became something more, you know?
Well, right. I mean, so she had this ex-husband that she wanted killed because he was abusive.
Absolutely.
Right? So, disproportionate, for one. She didn't want him beat up. She wanted him killed.
Oh, yeah.
So, disproportionate response. And, you know, this... you know, there are lesser, you know, a scaled down examples of this kind of behavior with, like, say, false rape accusations, where the, you know, women are out for revenge. And I'm not saying guys don't do this, because we're talking about this, the female side of this dynamic and how she got so deep into this. I think it's fascinating, you know, that, you know, trying to relieve this hurt, they want to hurt other people. And we see it on large and small scales in, you know, and how that need to hurt these people who hurt her led her to this guy, which led her into this, you know, serial killer dynamic.
In this world where maybe she realizes she has a sexual attraction to what's going on.
Right.
To watching this guy, her man, as it were, do these things.
Right.
But, next one that they killed was a 20-year-old named Fabienne Leroy. On the 3rd of August, 1988, she was a biochemistry student, and she had just been shopping for groceries when she gets into the car after Monique, at this point, is 8 months pregnant, and she gets into the car after Fournier asks, "Can you show us where there's a local doctor?" Hmm. So, I mean, this is a pretty profoundly sick way to manipulate people when you're using your own pregnancy to do that.
And it works. It would work for almost anybody, I gotta say.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's ironclad once you get down to it.
Yeah. I mean, there's almost nobody who would be suspicious of a pregnant woman.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, as much as we know about how manipulative people can be and all this shit, I wouldn't be suspicious. I can't say that, you know, that I would be any better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the other interesting observation that a forensic shrink I was reading about who looked into this that he made, whenever Monique was with, there weren't any survivors. But whenever it was just Fournier, there were. So that's kind of a testimony. Yeah. It's kind of a testimony as to how the dynamic ramps up when she's around, you know?
Yeah, that's fascinating because, you know, there are cases, like they say that in the Fred and Rose West case, that Rose would not have evolved into a killer without Fred. But in here we're saying she actually may have spurred him on to becoming a killer. She was the catalyst.
Yes. Yeah, I think that arguably she was. But at any rate, yeah, with Fabienne, when she gets into the car, Fournier tells Monique to hold a gun to her head while he ties her up. And this sort of becomes a signature behavior with the other ones that they abduct. And the other thing that he has her do when they're in the car is check to see if she's a virgin. Mm. Which the only thing that can possibly mean is checking for an intact hymen. At least as far as I know.
I guess, yeah, yeah, that was the test. Yeah.
Yeah. Even though it's total bullshit, as you and I were talking about.
Yeah.
Off air.
But it's what people knew to do, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's still false information going around.
Sure. The only reason why virginity has been valued so highly is because of nobility, you know, mm-hmm. wanting to guarantee bloodlines.
Passing on property to real progeny.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they don't want, you know, their new daughter-in-law to be bringing in some bastard child into the family who's going to inherit.
Right.
That's the only reason.
Yeah, that is. That's it. It's absurd to the nth degree.
Yeah.
That people are still obsessed with that. And I think it kind of speaks as to how Fournier views most women as dirty and as property once you get down to it. Right. You know? But, yeah, that all becomes the signature behaviors for them. And, he also has a tendency to get very annoyed if his wife cannot give him a solid answer as to whether she's a virgin or not. You know, go figure.
Wait. His wife can't?
Yeah, if she... feels down there and
not about herself. I was gonna say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, if his wife feels down there and can't tell him whether the victim is a virgin or not, he has a tendency to fly into a rage. Figure with that.
Maybe find out before they get so committed. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like you said at the beginning, this is a very strange case.
It's a very strange case, and rationality does not play a huge role here.
Yeah, not at all, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, like we were saying, the victims are basically there to act just as an adjunct to the pleasure of Monique and Fournier. And they both get their jollies from the terror that's being inflicted here. And the gradual exertion of domination, too, I think is also very important. And the height almost of it was getting the victim to ask him, "Mister, will you make love to me?" Then the manipulation is kind of over in his mind, but You know, symbolically, with something like that, the victim is requesting her own sacrifice at his hand once you get down to it. But, and it also, almost always, when wifey is involved too, involves murdering the victim, as we said.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, Fabienne's body was found at a secluded spot at an army base. Let's see, Olivia claims she tried to take a walk while this was being done, but there's likely no way that she did, because Fournier, he took a sawed-off shotgun to her face.
Oh.
To Fabienne's face. And then just dumped the body. It's kind of a weird way to do it once you get down to it, if you're a lust murderer.
Mm-hmm.
Like Fournier is. They very rarely use guns. Very, very rarely.
Right, because they like the up-close and personal aspect.
Exactly, of a knife or of strangulation.
Yep.
But apparently before they shot her, they tried killing her by an air embolus. Because they found needle marks.
Oh, the old trope of injecting air into the vein?
Yep.
Hey, pro tip, it doesn't work. Guess
nope.
Because guess what your blood is designed to carry? Oxygen.
Yeah, I don't know where they had the bright idea of trying that.
According to one doctor that I heard, even if you injected a syringe full of air directly into the heart, it probably wouldn't do anything.
Wow. Yeah. Dang. But yeah, just to give a little bit of a window into their relationship, when they would have meals with neighbors, allegedly, Monique was very submissive to Fournier, to the point that she wasn't allowed to speak unless he okayed it.
Wow.
But she was very dominant in the murders with what was getting done. So,
That's a curious change of pace.
It is. It really is. They had a psychological profile of them done. And for Fournier, they were saying megalomaniac, manipulative, sexually perverse, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then for Olivier, egocentric, heartless, highly intelligent, and also perverse, of course.
Yeah. And
once you get down to it, the actual the conclusion there, the two need each other.
Yeah, you know, the chemical reference that I made earlier to being the catalyst, and, you know, it's like epoxy for a very common chemical combination that people are familiar with. You have these two compounds that are just liquids by themselves, but when you mix them together in the right mm-hmm. ratios, you get a hard resin.
Oh, yeah.
And absolutely. A lot of heat. And, you know, one of them is the one that really triggers that to happen. That's the catalyst.
Yep.
And if they're kept separate, nothing happens.
Yeah, but then you put them together.
Yeah.
That's where I think with Fournier, what he was wanting was absolute power. But he couldn't get it without her, of course. You know, and she often, like we were saying, would set the murders up by, you know, playing the mother in the whole thing.
Well, see, that's exactly what I was. That's kind of where I was. My head was going with this because he needed her to tell him what to do, to order him around, to do what he wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, basically, like yeah, that's did. What it boils down to. But, yeah, we're finally getting to the chateau, interestingly enough. They bought that in 1989 after he, when Fournier was in prison, he met somebody by the name of Heligok and his wife Farida. And apparently Heligok told him about a spot in the National Forest in France where there was buried treasure, for lack of a better term. It was the proceeds of a number of bank robberies different criminals. Yeah, that was buried there. And so when F gets out...
I'm surprised the story wasn't buried Nazi gold, because that would have seemed more appropriate to the region.
Yeah, it definitely would. But he told Fournier where it was, where it might be buried anyway, as a gold stash outside Paris. So he went, and Fournier went, and he talked to Farida, his wife, about the whole thing, figuring she might know. So Fournier and Olivier sort of worm their way into her life, using her as a patsy to try to get at this gold. And it works. They get out there, they start digging, and they actually freaking find it.
What?
Yeah.
No. That's not supposed to happen.
These two totally devilish people find buried treasure in France.
Oh, for crying out loud.
So they keep it around, because the one big problem there, they're having issues fencing the gold that was in there. And they keep it around for about 2 years, and then they finally find somebody in Brussels who will buy it. So they do that, but at the same time, Heligok is sort of bugging them because he's out and he can't find his wife, Farida. Right? So he keeps bugging them about that, and they're like, well, we don't know. And they end up killing and burying both of them, Heligok and Farida. And then they keep the... roughly 1.2 million francs that the gold was worth, and that's what they used to buy the chateau.
Ah, fascinating.
Yep. And they ended up bringing quite a few more girls to that chateau, unfortunately. And it's really the sort of perfect cover. Let's see. We talked a bit about Jean Marie. She was one that they had brought to the chateau. And after they killed her, they buried her on the grounds. And that's a pattern that they would repeat throughout the rest of this. And, oh, yeah, I had forgotten about that part. When they raped her in front of their child.
Oh.
And strangled her, put the body on ice, and then buried it.
Wow.
And the
got to start them young, I guess. Jesus.
Yeah. It's disgusting. But... they used their own child, who was now 3 months, to grab their next one, who was a 12-year-old by the name of Elizabeth. She was raped, but not immediately killed. And her remains they didn't find for 15 years after all this.
Jeez.
And throughout this, they had been crossing all over France and into Belgium, too. And one thing that made it a lot harder for the authorities to catch them is that you had two competing serial killers at the same time.
In the same region?
One guy in Belgium, and that was Marc Dutroux, who I think we have a picture of, the younger
Coming right
guy
up.
with the younger fellow with the mustache. And then we have in France, Amélie Louis. There's Dutroux, yeah. Kind of looks like a young Dennis Rader.
Yeah, it kind of does.
But yeah, and then Amélie Louis, who was the older one.
So not two, but three in the same region at the same time?
Yep.
Holy crap. That'd have to be, unless they had significantly different MOs.
They were close enough.
That would
and
be
they were
really
worried.
That would be really confusing for the police.
Yep.
And did all three of them cross the borders?
I'm pretty sure they did. Yeah.
So now you
Although
have
jurisdictional
confusion on top of everything else.
Yep. Between the Belgians and the French. But yeah, I mean, throughout this, Fournier and Olivier just kept on killing. The next one they found was in Belgium, a girl by the name of Natasha, kidnapped, raped, and killed. With that man, they had falsely accused a man and they jailed him, and he committed suicide over it.
Whoa.
So there's that. And that was 1990, and they honestly didn't kill again until the year 2000.
Why?
Which I'm not sure why.
Yeah.
That's a long cooling off period.
You don't see that very often. And I think Rader has a longer one, but
you don't long.
Typically see that.
No, you don't.
Was it to raise the kid?
Good question. I mean, they killed a girl by the name of Celine, was the one in 2000.
Yeah.
And then in 2003, this is when it gets more interesting. June 26th, in the town of Cine, Cinney, there's a Burgundian girl there, age 13, who is spoken to by Fournier, and he says he's lost, and she says, I showed him the way, and then he forced me to get into the back of his van. She goes on, he tied my hands and feet and pushed me into the back of his van. I was really panicking because I could see a map of Belgium and France, and she knew all about Amélie Louis and Marc Dutroux by this time. So she starts praying aloud, and this apparently gets on Fournier's nerves. So he threatens to slit her throat. She asks, Monsieur, are you a member of the Dutroux gang? He says, no, I'm not a member of the Dutroux gang. I'm worse. They're driving. They approach a town called Beaurang, which is about 30 kilometers away. The girl manages to free herself from the ropes. She jumps out of the back of the van and is picked up by a passing motorist.
Wow.
So what they do, they park and sort of collect themselves, and they see Fournier driving by in that same van again. So they take down his license plate and his face. And they arrest him the same day.
Observant citizens.
Yeah. Tough little girl, too.
No
to
shit.
Go through that.
No shit.
Resourceful
and courageous.
Yep. And then at the trial, he ended up getting two life terms and Monique Olivier, because she did quite a lot of testifying against him got 28 years to life. So she could be paroled after the 28. In theory.
And when would but that... When?
I want to say 2031.
Okay.
If 2031, 2032, something like that.
I mean, if that was in this country, I'd say this is like a, this is one of the cases where there, it doesn't matter if they're eligible for parole. Nobody is going to vote to put her on parole.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
being France, who knows?
Yeah. And it's an odd one, that's for sure. Let's hope they don't get out. Just vicious.
So, they're both in prison. They're both still alive.
I think so. Let me check that again. Let me kill... Wait a minute. Fornere. He is alive and 77. Monique Olivier. And it just brings up her. Oh, wait, no, not a swimmer. Yeah.
No,
yeah,
not,
she's
not
still
that
alive,
one.
Too.
All right.
Born in 1948.
I hope they're having a very miserable time in prison.
Me, too. Me, too.
Yeah, that's it's so strange to have three different serial killers in a pretty small region.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, at least with a place like California, you have quite a lot of space.
Right.
You know? But yeah, I mean, Germany and Belgium, it's kind of tiny in comparison.
Yeah. Right along that French-Belgian border.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy.
It is, man. Wow.
See, serial killers aren't just Americans.
Nope.
It just seems like it.
Yeah, it just seems like we have a monopoly on it, but we don't. Crazy is everywhere.
It really is. Well, and it's not just crazy either. You know, it's that, you know, structural defect in the brain that causes sociopathy. That's the underlying a lot of this.
Very true. I mean, you could call it moral insanity, but yeah, I mean, definitely.
Well, you could call it that, but it's not really a learned thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the behaviors are learned, but the lack of empathy is, you know, that's a structural problem.
Mm-hmm. It's ingrained. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that about covers it for today.
I believe it does.
All right. Well, we're not going to do a weird-ass Stephen King type of ending where we just stop. We'll actually say, that's the end.
Yeah, no soprano stopping in mid-sentence either.
Right. All right. Thanks again, Wes, for your extensive research and contribution. It's been a good show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Good night.